the reporter who was there was cut in a downsize. And behind me, the Baltimore Sun has given up its White House position. So it's just all around us. These news organizations have downsized or just simply gone out of existence. But radio seems to have more held its own.
Well, it all depends what type of radio organization it is. But
how many affiliates do you have?
We have over 300 affiliates.
And is that, what about 12 years ago?
12 years ago, you know, the numbers fluctuated. We had at one time 475, but a lot of stations have been sold. A lot of stations have merged under different umbrellas. But we've held steady with certain stations. But what's happening is now we're finding that a lot of these stations are trying to hold their own. Revenue is tight. Revenue is very tight. And that's like with newspaper advertisement and like with a lot of magazines. If you look in your magazines 12 years ago or 5 years ago versus today, a lot of magazines are thinner. A lot of our ad time is not where it used to be. So that's what drives radio. That's what drives newspaper, you know, advertisement. And once that happens, there's a problem. So we've cut positions within the organization. But one thing they say we have to have is the White House correspondent. So
in looking at advertising, I know one local television has been hit hard by people not buying cars. Mm. So you know, car dealers were just number one for local television stations. And in fact, the local ABC station here offered $2,000 to all of its employees for a car, for them to purchase cars. And the idea was that they wanted to help the car industry because they were so dependent upon it. And grocery stores, I notice I'm still getting the stuff for the grocery stores, but it's true, you sure don't see much about cars.
You don't.
What kind of advertising would you have in the city?
Well, in my newscast, because every day I have several reports, but one major report is a long form report, and it's called the White House Report. And I have to be very sensitive. They're very sensitive to the kinds of commercials or ads that I run. And one of the ads is the Realtors Association, the National Realtors Association, National Association of Realtors. And because of the slump in the housing market, they're trying to really get out there and say, look, go to your local realtor. You might be able to find a bargain right now. And, you know, it's interesting in radio and in any advertisement, the first thing you do, they say, when there is a problem financially, instead of tightening up your advertising budget, that's when you should go out and advertise to generate publicity for yourself, for people to come around and try to buy and purchase your mm-hmm. product.
Uh-huh. So how many reports do you do, and how do they differ?
It varies. With this president, and I was talking to a reporter recently, with this president, it is very hard to cover him. And I say this in all honesty and sincerity. This president is a dynamo. He's come in every day. He's got 2 and 3 events. And typically what happens, you know, there's 1 or 2 great events, and you can kind of say, you know, in the morning he did this, and then in the afternoon he did this. But this president, as soon as he finishes one thing, he's going into another, or it's, you know, I can easily say he has like 3 events some
yeah.
days. You know, some days he actually has 3 events. And you have to really, I mean, because it's really hard to cover all 3 events adequately. Now, if they are impacting enough, what I try to do is cover each one and maybe do 3 stories each, so that's like 9 stories. Some stories I would, you know, if he had 1 event, like the Women and Girls Initiative, I would maybe do 2 or 3 stories in that, and he had some other things. So really I tried to focus in on that day, because that was very big for him, because one, this is a man who got the black vote, got the female vote, you know, and that was very big. You know, he followed through on a campaign promise that, look, I'm going to work with you. You know, also that week, I believe I did a story on the Urban Affairs office. And then you have other things during the day, and that doesn't even include enterprise stories. Today, for instance, you know, the president was gone, but I worked on the issue of him traveling to Iraq. I had talked to General Barry McCaffrey. I talked to P.J. Crowley, formerly of the Clinton administration. Then I'm trying to find out about President Obama and church. You know, the big story now is, where is he going to choose a church? So I found one of the advisory board members on Facebook. Yeah, everybody looked up with that. I found one of the advisory board members, and I can't stand Facebook because I'm not technologically inclined yet, but it's working. So I found her on Facebook. She said, how did you find her? I said, I can't tell. It was divine intervention. And she happens to be a bishop, and she's in his faith-based initiative. She called me back. I just sent her a message. She called me back. And I thought that was the most interesting thing. So I said, you know, I said, this is so interesting. She said, and she couldn't believe that I found her on Facebook. But she responded. So, and we're going to do the interview. She didn't have time because she was in the meeting. They actually had a meeting today. I didn't even know it. I was just trying to find out about this church thing. And, you know, so we're going to do an interview tomorrow about what this faith-based initiative is about, especially, well, not faith-based initiative, the Office of Faith, I believe. I don't remember the new name for it under the Obama administration. But, you know, especially as we're going into one of the most holiest times of the year for various faiths, you know, what is this office doing? So that's one component. And then also I'm going to ask her, look, you know, when the president's picking a church here, what kind of church would he pick? And it's really a political issue. I talked to one of my political sources. I'm going to give you something real quick. I talked to one of my political sources a while ago, and I said, what kind of church?
This is video streamed and it's archived.
Okay, but I'm not going to say the name. Okay. I said, what kind of church? Okay, I said, what kind of church should the president go to or attend? And I'm not going to say the names of the church. I'm not going to say the names of the person. But this is something that they consider, and this is something that's a nuance for us to add in our stories. I said, what about such and such church? Slow, non-controversial bunch of older Americans. Another church, not sure that it's a good fit for the children, meaning the Obama children. Another church, very progressive and lots of former presidents. Then another church, they're talking about the ministry.
So and close by.
Yeah, and close by. And the list goes on. So when they pick a church or pick something, they put a lot of thought into it. It might be a spiritual uplift for him, but it's a lot of politics that go into the politics of choosing a church. So everything has got some kind of political spin, some kind of nuance. So I was working on that today. What else am I working on? Oh, I'm going to Mexico next week, and I'm working on the issue of drugs. And it's not just about drugs with Mexico. It's the economy. It's the cartels. It's immigration, the border, you know, the border security. You know, you have all this. How many of you went to Mexico for spring break?
This year?
You did.
Oh, no, that was this year.
Oh, you did. Okay, okay. All right, yeah, you went?
We were all here.
Oh, okay, okay.
Okay. They went to the tidal basin.
Okay. But isn't it interesting that
cherry blossoms are great.
They are. Horrible on the allergies, but isn't it interesting that the State Department will come out and say, look, we're advising you young people, don't go. That's amazing. So right now, because of all of the border issues with Mexico, a lot of the border cities are having the problems with the shootouts, the drug cartels, this fighting. And I mean, it's something that you never thought you'd see. And I mean, Mexico is having a major problem. So the president's going down there, and he has to address this because this is a serious problem. It causes a lot of immigration issues. Refugees can cross the border. Well, we're trying to shore up our homeland. It's so many different stories that come out of this. So these are some of the things that I was dealing with in one day.
Yeah,
so, and that's a lot. So I consider it almost like a master's program, something like you were giving the students earlier. This is you're always learning and always researching. Every day is something new, and you have to always. I mean, your sources, talking to people, use new age technology. Who would have thought I would have found a source on Facebook and they would have responded? That was amazing. So
what One of the things that's different about your reporting, I think because you were in Washington really by yourself for your news organization, is you deal with all parts of the government.
Yes.
So when you get response, like say you talk to Clyburn on a regular basis and lots of other people on the Hill on a regular basis, and then people within within the urban and the black community with interest groups of various sorts, whether it's the NAACP, Urban League, or whatever. So you have a really broad base to draw from.
And I also did an AIDS story today. I forgot. AIDS story. They just released $45 million for AIDS. So it's how many stories was that? That's like four or five stories in one day, and you've got to keep counting.
Different ones, yeah. And do you have to update each of those?
Yes, you do.
That one you had to update because they gave you the wrong figures.
Yeah, they gave you the wrong figures. It was ridiculous. You have something on paper, you go back to check with the White House, and then somebody says, oh, no, this is the number. And I said, are you sure? And they went back and checked, oh, you were right all along. So, you know, you have to go back and redo, but... Yeah. You know, those things happen.
Well, how did you get into this business? How did you get to Washington and to the White House?
I stumbled into it for real. it was weird. I got into the business because I loved the adrenaline rush. I loved finding out about what was going on. I wanted to know what affected me and what affected the people around me. I like the fast pace. I said, I could hang with this. I could be this. This is me. And you either have to love it or you hate it. There's no gray area. And I found myself loving it. I loved getting the information fast and being the first with it, breaking news. I was working in Baltimore. I went from Baltimore to Frederick, Maryland, to Chattanooga, Tennessee, back to Baltimore.
That was all on radio, right?
Yeah, radio and a little TV.
TV.
A little TV. A little TV in Baltimore, a little TV in Chattanooga, Tennessee. But it was mostly radio. My career is basically based in radio. And I started in radio in college, my freshman year. And my first program director, I don't know if any of you know this name, but his name was Kwaisi Mfume. Do you know that name? Sounds really familiar. He was a congressman in Maryland and the former head of the NAACP, the national head. And so some of us do go on to bigger and better things.
So he ended up being a good source for you.
Yeah, well maybe so to some extent. To some extent, yes. And that's one thing. You never know who will be what, where they will be, and you always, I try to keep that bridge, a nice bridge there. Sometimes I burn my bridges, but but you always try to keep, you know, build the bridge, keep building the bridge, because you never know. I mean, who would have thought at that time he was a college radio station program director, and he wound up being a congressman and the head of the NAACP. And look at where I am, urban America. Let's talk, you know. So it works out. But while I was in Baltimore, things were drying up. It was a bad time financially in radio. And I was doing a little work over at WTOP. I was freelancing for my network where I am now. And something came up, and they said, would you like to come to Washington? And I said, sure. And it wound up being the White House. And it was very overwhelming at first. Number one, I replaced a man who had big shoes I had to fill. And I was just thrown into a situation. But it worked out. I mean, I remember wanting to quit after the first 6 months. And my mother told me, I remember her telling me, you have got to stay there for 2 years. I hate it. I said, oh, my gosh. But it wound up that I stayed there 10 more years after that, too. So,
you did more interviews, radio interviews with Clinton than any other reporter. Mm-hmm. How did you get those interviews, and did they talk to you about that and let you know that you were getting more interviews than anybody
no,
else?
No, how I found out, because many of my colleagues were very upset in the basement that I got those interviews. And I wasn't in the pool at the time. I was not in the pool. And they were just making such ruckus. And they said, look, you're getting this. You need to be in the pool. And really, I guess it made sense, because I would have been upset, someone coming in, not putting in all this work that I'm doing, and they're getting all the benefits. But for Clinton, I had an audience. He was considered the first black president at the time. And
until South Carolina.
But you know what? Well, wait.
No.
But that was a good point. But do you know, even after South Carolina, the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies came out with a poll in 2008, and it said that his high, I believe it was in 2000, poll rating in 2000 amongst African Americans was 91%. In 2008, after all of that stuff, guess where his numbers were? 85.5%. So he is still well loved in the black community.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So, and understanding that this president wanted to, he had the most diverse administration ever, still does, even as we have the first black skin-hued president, he still has the most diverse administration than any other president. He brought many African Americans to the table. If you notice, especially in the second term, he was really concerned about the issue of race. And he really wanted to bring that point home. And he would always talk to me. They would conduct interviews, you know, when he did this race initiative. I mean, we did interviews, I don't know, we always did interviews. And he wanted to put something out there, and he made news. And it worked for him. And he saw me as someone that he could put it out there, but I would ask the questions. I wouldn't beat him up. But at the same time, I would ask him questions. Because I remember asking him something on Afghanistan in one of the interviews. I mean, I've asked him on different subjects. But he knew that it was going to get out there. And they used me. And I guess it was a win-win situation. And that's everything has a political side to it. You know, if we use her, what benefit are we going to get from it? You know, if she does this interview. So I guess the benefits were great, because I got the most interviews. And I guess I need to ask, what benefits were there?
When you do an interview with the president, how long does it take? I mean, how long do they give you? How do they arrange it? Like, if you do it in the Oval Office, you know, how long do you wait beforehand? Do they bring you in, you have 30 seconds of small talk, and then 10 minutes of interview, and they toss you out? How does it work?
With Bill Clinton, it was they bring you in, he would come in, or he'd be waiting, and you have a couple seconds of small talk, and you get right into it. They were always told me 15 minutes, but it wound up being 30 minutes. Bill Clinton talked a lot. We used to say he had his monologues, not dialogues, but he talked a lot. I mean, he gave a lot of information. President Bush was very interesting. I had two. No, he was. I mean, I'm not saying that to be funny. We had two great interviews. The first, and I'll never forget this, on Air Force One, and this is, I'm glad that I'm remembering this. We were on Air Force One, and we were going to New Orleans. This was my first ever interview with this man. Now, granted, he called me at press conferences. And I think he was nervous, because black American George Bush did not have a love affair at all. Someone in the administration, and I'm not going to say the name, said this was a time that he could have rode in on his white horse with Katrina, and he failed. And I think that's when black America really got upset. And then you heard all the Kanye West stuff, George Bush doesn't like black people. I had that response from Mrs. Bush on the plane coming back from Mississippi when she said, what did she say?
That was a separate trip.
Yeah, that was a separate trip.
It
was a separate trip. But she responded to Kanye West. I broke news with that after Katrina. And that was a very emotionally fraught day to see those people the victims of Hurricane Katrina in that place. And it was a church that we attended. It was interesting. So we traveled, now going back to my interview with President Bush, they had a dual interview on Air Force One in the Flying Oval. And I've been on Air Force One before, but I've never ventured down into the nose of the plane. And it was the most fascinating thing. He took me for a little tour.
Did you ask him to take you?
No. He took me for a tour. He even took me back. He showed me where their beds, these are like twin beds, are on the, yes, twin beds. They had these twin beds, and it's above the pilot on the nose of the plane. And I said, wow. You know, he said, and he was showing me that, and he was talking to me, and he said, and this is when, and I'm going to say, because we've said it before, it's been published. He said to me, he said, April, you know, I'm serious about this. He said, there needs to be more black members of the press in the press room. And he said, you know, I'm not pandering to you. I said, I know you're not. And I said, you told me this before. And when you look out into that briefing room, it's a couple of us. Out of 50 people, it's myself and maybe a couple others, you know. So that press room does not reflect the diversity of America. But anyway, I digress, moving back. So while I was doing the interview with the president, and Hurricane Katrina is a very tense subject for the Bush administration, it is a wound that has not healed yet. And I don't think it'll ever heal. The scar tissue has not come formed yet. So while I was sitting there and I was asking him questions, I remember when we finished the interview, he went like that. He gave to the press secretary, because I think he was sweating bullets, because he knew it was a very tough situation. And here this black reporter who's covering New Orleans, you know, and I remember getting in trouble. It wasn't really, it was a big back and forth about Hurricane Katrina, about, because the president said, you know, April, when we come back, you know, 10 years from now, remember that? Mm-hmm. When we come back 10 years from now, we'll see. You know, the question was, how long will it take to rebuild New Orleans? And he said, when we come back 10 years from now. And then the White House got upset because people were saying that, and really, in essence, it really was, you know, he was saying, you know, it's going to take a while, because the people of New Orleans, he gave it to them to fix. And you still have New Orleans, a place that looks like a tinderbox in some areas. You know, you still see, people are still taking tours, finding wood splinters of homes. The place has not been rebuilt. So it's a very sensitive subject for the Bush administration, and they know it. And I remember that when he gave the thumbs up, like, mm-hmm. I passed the test. And it was just very interesting. And that was that interview. And in the last interview with Clinton, he let me sit in his chair at the Resolute desk, and he took my microphone like he was interviewing me. So
did he ask you any questions?
No, he just said, you're president for this moment. I said, oh my God, the world worked out. Nothing happened. I said, I was a good president. So.
Tell us, for all the different stories you do, what information do you get on a regular basis? How do you inform yourself? You know, what do you read? When do you start reading? And what do you read? And listen to as well.
I drive in. I listen to CNN and Fox on XM. When I drive into work from Baltimore, that's about a two-hour trip, so I get the gist of the news as I'm driving in every day. I get up in the morning. The first thing I do is turn on my television to one of the news channels, one of the cable news channels. Unfortunately, I don't watch local news. I don't have time to watch local news, and I live in Baltimore, so I don't know what's going on in my community. Then I'll go down. This is about 5 in the morning.
Do you do that just to make sure that nothing huge has happened overnight?
Right. I make sure nothing huge has happened, that I'm abreast of everything, or as much as I can be. I'll go downstairs, turn on my computer, and I'll try to go through.
What time would this be?
This could be anywhere between 5:20, 5:30 in the morning. And I try to, and the reason why I do this, I have two children too. Yeah. So you get up early. And Dr. Kumar knows sometimes I've emailed her like 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock, or 5 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, it's no rest for, I mean, seriously, no rest for the weary. I mean, you're always working, you're always on. And I'll go through a lot of urban blogs that see what's going on. And then I'll go through a little bit of the Washington Post, look at the front page. I'll try to. What other paper? I'll go through the Times, a little bit of the front page, if I can. Because by 6 o'clock, I'm upstairs. Now I'm watching TV again at 6 o'clock. I'm going through emails, looking at what the White House put out overnight, daily guidance, looking at the sources, emails from sources. From everyone wants to get your attention who's outside the White House, some kind of interest group. They send you all sorts of emails. My AOL account is always jammed. It's always full because I get so many of those emails. So I have to go through the emails and check what's going on. Because a lot of times there's a lot of news nuggets in there that could work in a story. By 6:30, I'm upstairs. I'm away from the computer. And I have my BlackBerry. I check my BlackBerry while I'm in the kitchen cooking. And really by 6:30, 7 o'clock, I'm out. I'm away from the computer until I get to work, 9, 10 o'clock, what have you. So, but I have my BlackBerry. And
do you do any interviews when you're on the road?
Yes. Don't tell anybody.
Not that you're texting.
No, I'm not texting, but people will call. And if I'm on the road, I call my minivan, my movable office. Today, I did an interview on the phone with P.J. Crowley about Iraq.
Is he going to be the spokesman at the State Department?
I don't know. I don't know. Well, we talked, so I don't know. But he said to me, he said, this Iraq issue for the president to go there, even though he's moving the focus to Afghanistan, it refocuses in on Iraq as there are more issues that are going to come up with Iraq. They still have to build themselves up before we can, before we actually leave next year.
Now, Crowley was the NSC press person in the Clinton administration, and then he went to work at the Center for American Progress and doing NSC kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there has been discussion that he's going to be the spokesman at the State Department. Well, let's take some questions, and let's go to Towson first, and then we'll do you all go back and forth.
Yes, ma'am. What has been your personal reaction between the first African American in the White House?
What's my personal reaction?
Seeing the first black president in the White House.
As an African American who's 5 generations removed from the last known slave in my family, I am ecstatic, but it has its place and its time. I paused for history, but I have to view him as a president like I view any other president. Reporters have to hold him accountable, and I have to do that. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I love the fact there is an African American that is a president of the United States of America. And that is, it's a very emotional and moving thing. But I can't look at that. I have to look at the fact that he is a president, and I have to question him. And I have to be fair to myself, to be fair to the American public, and to be fair to him, I have to ask him the real questions. And I have to be sincere about what I do. Thank you.
Somebody here? Okay, let's start here first, and then we'll go.
Well, let's go all the way in the back for a minute.
Okay,
I like the back
in front.
I feel close to her because she's in the back. Throw your voice really loud.
It seems you have a lot of personal relationships with the presidents that you've covered, and I was wondering how you kind of maintain your distance and maintain your objectivity in covering these presidents.
Well, they know I'm going to ask. Bill Clinton used to always say he hated calling on me because I would get him in trouble. Because I'd ask the questions that they weren't necessarily prepared for. And not only that, he would have to really, you know, when you deal with the front row, they kind of know the news of the day that they're going to ask. What did Joe Lockhart say? Joe Lockhart said that they were kind of a hyper-aggressive group that moved in mass. I'm kind of weird. I might move
Joe
in mass.
Joe was a press secretary for Clinton. He was the third press secretary.
Yes. I move in mass sometimes, but then other times I'm like, hey, forget the group. I'm going to go off on my own. So, you know, and Bush knew that. But Bush also knew, I'll never forget, we were in Jackson Place when they moved us out of the White House for a moment, and he was having a press conference in Jackson Place. And someone had asked on Katrina, and I was in the third row, and he said, April, I know you have a follow-up, and I sure did. So, you know, sometimes they know, mm-hmm. and sometimes they don't. I mean, like when I can remember Africa, there were issues of the Sudan, and the president was glad that I had asked that. But I also asked the question. I was the first one to ask him this question about the recession. And he said to me, it was February 2008, I had an interview with him in the Oval Office. It was after this Africa, he got this big award for all his efforts in Africa. And he said to me, I asked him, we talked about Africa, but I said, Mr. President, is this country in a recession or are we going into a recession? And he said, no, we are not in a recession and we will not be going into a recession. We were in a recession at that time. And then I asked him again, I asked him in April and I asked him at another time. And I said, you know, Congressman James Clyburn said something, as a man thinketh, so is he. And I said, American public is thinking we're in a recession, you know. And he said, what did he say? He said, I can't help what people think, but we're not in a recession. We're here. So you remember that, don't you?
Yeah. I do.
So, but they expect, and they know that I may ask a black question. They know that that's my focus. But I could ask a question about black America, but I can also ask a question about the world and America. So, you know, sometimes they can pin me down and other times they can't. And you always want to keep them guessing.
Although, on the other hand, if you are predictable, then if you've been asking a particular question in the briefing room or there's an issue you're interested in that's up that day, the likelihood that you might be called on would be greater. For example, in the last press conference,
I didn't get a question.
There was a, but you may have been on the list. there was a question that was asked by a person from Univision.
Yes.
They called on her, and that day they had Obama had issued a something that dealt with border security.
Yes.
So they could be pretty sure that she would ask about it, and so calling on her would resonate to a different audience because
right.
it was a prime time newser. So in a way, in that case, calling on her, being pretty sure what she would ask would be helpful.
And I think they pretty much knew that I was going to ask about race if I would have gotten a question, because that the next day, the state of black America came out by the National Urban League, the report. And the report was something like this. There's a tale of two black Americas, one of pride for the first black president and the other of wide gaps, socioeconomic gaps along the spectrum. So I think they would have known it would have been something like that, because there were actually two race questions. One definite race question and one that was poverty, but it kind of led into, you know, the urban agenda.
Mm-hmm. Towson?
I'm just trying to keep you. Sorry, I really like that. Making the distinction between black America and mainstream America. Do you think that making a conscious decision to separate these two Americas is kind of perpetuating the separation, or do you think it's important to highlight the differences?
When you still have a problem in a community, and this community's having a worse problem than another community, what are you going to do? You can't walk away from it. We are unfortunately in a situation in the society where there's still a lot of gaps. You know, there are gaps educationally. You know, I could live in a rich district, and I could be black. And in my cousin could live down the road in a poor district and black. And you're not going to get the same level of education or learning or study or what have you. So until things are on a level where the gaps are not as wide, you're going to have that reporting. I mean, you know, when you hear that the unemployment rate is 7.6% overall, and then the black unemployment rate is 12.6%, whereas the white unemployment rate is 7.6%, that is worth reporting. And I mean, the question now is why? Why is that gap there? How do you fix it? It is about race, but it's not about race. That's when you report. I mean, you know, if there's something going on in the white community, there's a, you know, rich white America, poor white America, I'm going to report on it. But does that separate? Does that still keep a separation between white America or mainstream America? You report on it to fix the problem, to hold people accountable to address the problem. And that's what reporters, a real reporter's job is to do, to be as objective as you possibly can and put it out there so that people know what the situation is, the true situation is. I hope I answered your question.
Now, do you have it, the microphone?
You said that you write 4 to 5 stories a day, and I write for the Daily Bruin at UCLA, and we consider 2 articles a week, like, a lot. So I was just wondering how in the world you get that done, and on top of going to all the events that you have to go to as well, it just seems like, how do you write a complete article or story?
How do you write a complete sentence or have a complete thought with all that? You know what? I've gotten to the point, because this president has a tendency to just, it's everything is up and down. I said, you know what? It's better to be in the room sometimes because you see the nuances. But at some points, I'm like, look, I've got, in order for me to do it, because sometimes you have to stand in the room an hour before the event actually starts. And at that time, you could be working on your sources, you could be working the story up. Yeah. And then you have to do the event. You know, we're there a lot of times before the guests even come in now, because that was not the case before. But now we're there before everyone comes in, and they filter in, and then you wait, and then the president comes in. And then once the president meets and greets everyone, now, in your mind, you're still working on this story, like, okay, you know, this is what I'm going to do. Then, you know, as he meets and greets with everyone, you're still standing there and waiting. The story's over, but he's meeting and greeting with everyone. Then he leaves. Then everyone else has to file out. We're still in the room waiting to leave. That's too much time that's elapsed. And then there's another event. So I have to really pick and choose what I do, and I have to really, really think. I have to plan out my time. You have to be really smart in how you do it. And unfortunately, when I'm in the building, I'm there, I'm getting it piped in, and I see the people, because a lot of times the people actually come out and go to this thing called Stakeout. It's right off the West Wing. It's a bank of microphones where they'll talk to the reporters, and we still get the story. And some of us even call the people or find them, you know, later on. But there's several ways of attacking it. But when you've got news stories coming in all the time, you have to really watch how you do it. And I get the story, I type it up, I write it up and edit it, put my voice to it, do 3 or 4 of them, and then try to get it out, send it remotely through my remote connection to my company in Pittsburgh. And then I'm gearing up for the next story or the next event or the briefing. So, I mean, there are so many different components to the day, and you just really have to figure out how to plan it. And I'm telling you, those 2 stories, you're going to be like, oh, that was a breeze when you look back.
Do you ever think that you don't cover a story, like, justly enough or give it enough coverage? Or are you unsatisfied ever because you have such limited time?
For me, I have 35 seconds, and I have to say a lot, 35 seconds. I don't have time for a lot of fluff. I have to get right to the meat. I've got to get the impacting stuff. I try to pick out the most important things. And if I don't put it in that piece, I'll put it that other nuance. And that's why we have several different angles, you know. I'll put that nuance that I didn't get in this piece in the other one, you know. But it's the same story, but it's got a different angle. So I try my best. You know, I can honestly say when I leave, I've done my best. Today I'm a little upset because of the back and forth about the amount of money. But the story is sound, but the amount of money, and that's not my fault, because I was double checking, and the administration official had some issues with numbers. But, but you know, I mean, that's where I'm upset, but that's something out of my control. But I really try to do my best and give my best. I really do when I come to it. I try my best.
Thanks. Towson?
When you came to our class last semester, you had a number of predictions about how the Obama administration would pan out.
Did I hit any?
Well, actually, I was going to ask you, what were you surprised about? Because most of your predictions were about the press room, where I don't go, obviously. So what were you right about? What were you wrong about?
Could you remind me about my predictions? I'm glad
One that stood out in my mind was you said that a lot of the major networks were sending African reporters to the press room. I believe that's what you said anyway.
You broke up there. Go back on the prediction.
As I recall, one of them that you said was that a lot of the major networks would start sending African American reporters to the press room.
Yes.
Because that would work better for what they were going for now with the new black president. Uh-huh. But then just a few minutes ago, you said there were actually only three now in the press room. So were you wrong about that, or was it just something that hasn't happened yet, or what do you think?
CNN did. Yeah, CNN did. A lot of these, and you know, the New York Times, Glenn Cooper.
Yeah.
She's there. There are a couple other.
But he's been there before.
Yeah, Fletch has been there before, the Washington Post. There's a little bit more, and unfortunately, there was a hypersensitivity when this first black president came. Everybody was talking about, we're going to have black people coming in. You know all the black people that came in? It was the black media primarily, the specialty media. But I think at the end of the day, so you have Suzanne Nouveau, you have myself, you have Dan, you have Wendell Golder, you have Fletcher, you have Helene Cooper. That's five right now that I can remember off the top of my head. And then you got a lot of other ones that don't have seats that are sitting in the back of the room. There are a lot more African Americans that come. Oh, and Darlene Superville from AP. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's six. Now, those are for the major organizations or the organizations that have seats and who have space in the White House. But you do have a lot more African Americans that come. There are a couple of people, I don't know who they're coming for, but they're some TV people, but I don't know who they are. But as far as the major organizations,
they come in an intermittent basis.
Yeah, yeah.
So they might be there every couple of weeks or something like that.
Yeah, but some of the organizations did add some people, and some of them, they brought back people who are of color and added some people. So I thought it might have been more, but, you know, it is what it is. And unfortunately, you know, I think we need to stop looking through the eyes of race and just say, look, do it because it's, you know, because this person should be there. But unfortunately, you know, it is what it is.
What hasn't changed on a daily basis is the number of people who are asking questions that deal with the black community or with urban America. That there are reporters, like, say, Wendell Goller, who was Fox and has been with Fox for some while, who's black. But his organization is not particularly interested in issues that are going to be dealing with the black community.
Well, it was interesting today. He was worried about Fox News, Wendell Goller. He was working on the story about where Barack Obama is going to go to church, the black church. So, I mean, especially, and the reason why I guess he was really, his news outfit was concerned about it because it was such a pivotal issue about Obama and his faith when he ran for the office of president, and Jeremiah Wright, the controversy with Jeremiah Wright. So now they're trying to figure out everybody's trying to figure out what church is going to go to. So
yeah, we shall probably going to have somebody who's a little lower key.
I think so. I think that's a very good
assumption. Did you predict the number of people, Brian, when she was there, you can be the truth teller here. Did she talk about how many additional people there would be coming to the White House on a regular basis in the briefing room?
I don't think we talked about that.
In the Bush administration, in the last year of the Bush administration, everybody was out in the road. News organizations, you know, were underfunded, and they had a super race. So what happened was that there were just not a lot of reporters that were there. So in the press secretary's briefing, you might have had, you know, you might have had 25 people when Dana Perino was doing a briefing. When Robert Gibbs was doing his briefing, when he started out, there could be 160 people in the room, and it's gone down, but it's still, I mean, it's under 100, but there are 49 seats, and those 49 seats are filled, and then there are people around, so it's still, you know, it's very definitely a news magnet, even if it's very long, because one of the problems with the day, too, is that his briefing can last an hour, pretty close to an hour, and he can be late. They gave a two-minute warning recently, and he was 45 minutes before he came. So television people were really upset about it. But that adding of time means that like April has to do a story elsewhere. Obama's late as well, so when he has three or four events, to put in extra time, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes, is a lot, has a lot of impact on how people do their reporting.
And it's very frustrating. We kind of grumble amongst ourselves down the day. It's very
that particular day when he was 45 minutes for the two-minute warning, people were, they certainly piped up. Somebody here. Okay.
Hi. You mentioned the president denying that we were in a recession. How do you deal with something like that, given the time constraints and dealing with it professionally? Do you press them on it?
I'll just say, why? Why do you feel that? And he'll explain why. And he did get into something. I forgot. He said the GDP stuff. They were, the White House, you know, kept going through this traditional term. You know, under traditional terms, and they were sending me some, I forgot, the department, their definition, because after the traditional terms, they started saying, wait a minute, things might not be right. They sent me to another department and let me see their guideline. But after a while, you couldn't deny it. You just could not deny it. And, but at that time, I asked him about it. He gave me his answer, and I said, why? And then I went on into the Africa things, because if an interview could turn sour fast, you have to keep it upbeat where he, and not just upbeat, but you want the best answers in the best way from him. You don't, I didn't frame it. I just said, you know, are we in a recession? And, you know, he said, no, we're not going to be, you know, what have you. But you try to gauge if it's something you should press. And my thing was, he made news right there. And I still had other things to ask. I mean, I could really mess myself up and not get good answers if I wanted to press them. And you have to kind of be a judge of that, too, because certain people, especially President Bush, you have to really watch people like that, because if you say the wrong thing, you can shut them down, and it's just the interview is just messed up for the rest of the day, you know, or the whole time you have. So you have to really kind of gauge who they are and what they will do and know, I guess, study the person before you ask.
You had several interviews with Obama. You had an interview with him when he was a senator,
yes.
And then when he was a candidate. Mm-hmm. And what were the circumstances of those interviews, and what were they like?
It was very interesting to.
How many have you had? Because you've not had one yet.
Not as president, but I had at least four or five. Now I got to remember. But I remember coming back to the White House after maternity leave. I got one with him. I had Bill Clinton, and then right after that, I had him. And I had about four or five of them. And he wanted to get a message out. But at the same time, I mean, he wasn't really harping on the issue of race. He was talking about issues that affected America. I asked him about the issue of drugs. I asked him about the issues of, I asked him about just the issues of the day. I asked him about issue, meaning when I say drugs, it was some issue. I forgot which issue it was, but I remember it was, I asked Hillary Clinton the same thing, and I used the answer because it was an issue that was in the news at the time. And I'm trying to remember which one it was. But either way, it was an issue about drugs. And then it was a news issue about drugs where I asked them to comment on, you know. And then there were some other issues that I asked about, you know, just things, what would you do if? You know, I remember talking to him about, you know, if president, you know, what would you do with race? How would you do this with education? How would you do that on the jobs front? What would you do with green jobs, you know? And especially he's pushing this green jobs thing when many people were saying it's too costly to go into a lot of these, to convert homes into green living. And you wouldn't see the benefit to way down the road. So I did a lot of those kinds of things in the interviews.
Typically, how long did those interviews last?
About 15 minutes.
And would he be doing a whole series of them?
Yes, he did. And
so like they sit down and they just do them?
A phone chain, you know, he'd be on the phone and they just pick up.
Did they have a staff person who says, Okay, you know, this is your list, and this is the person you're going to be talking to.
I believe that was the case, because I remember the last interview he had. It was Thursday before the election, and it literally, I was supposed to do the interview, I think, like 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock or something like that. It wound up being 6 o'clock in the morning, and I was lucky my kids hadn't gotten up yet, and I tried to find a quiet place in the house in case the kids got up, and he was on the phone. I didn't know he was on the phone. I said, okay, let me get in. And so I said, where can I go? I was in my basement. And I sat down on my treadmill. The treadmill, it was laying flat, and it's a long way to sit down. And I said, oh. He said, boy, it sounds like you're having a hard time. I said, oh, no. I said, sit in there. Wow. So I didn't know you were on the phone. So we went into the interview. It was very interesting. But it was interesting. He was very early in the campaign, and he's very late now. So I guess, yeah. You know, there's no middle ground for him.
Okay. Let's see. We're here? Did we just finish? No, we're there. Okay. Sorry, Towson. I'll just forget which place we are.
Yeah, right in front there.
You mentioned earlier that Obama received the black vote and the woman's vote, and hypothetically, had Obama not been in the race, I think Hillary Clinton would have done the same. Would have won the woman vote and the black vote. Mm-hmm. So as an urban radio reporter that deals with issues, can you explain why it said that over 90% of African Americans vote a certain way?
Wait a minute. Say what you broke up again. I'm sorry. The in part. I'm sorry.
As an urban radio reporter that deals with many racial issues, can you give me your opinion why you think that over 90% of African Americans vote a certain way?
That's interesting. If they feel a party is not, I'm not speaking for all, but this is what I've noticed. If they feel a party is not taking care of their interests, they're not going to vote for them. And I don't think it's just African Americans. I mean, look at the Hispanic vote. Look at what happened with immigration, with that, you know, how they came out in mass. They were very strong. If you don't support a group of people in their interest, they're not going to vote for you. And that's just that's a common sense thing, and it's also a thing that it affects them on a daily basis. You know, people vote and support what affects them. So if someone is not stepping up to the plate and doing what I feel that they should be doing for me that affects my personal interests in my family and my neighborhood, I think that's where they are. I think it's really personal. I think communities take this personally, especially communities who feel like they have not been fairly given a fair shake, you know. So I think that's what it is. I believe that's what it is. I mean, it's my opinion. It's non-scientific, but that's what I've viewed.
Okay. Yep. Pass it over, and then we'll do you next.
One is about race relations, and It's a little long, so bear with me. So I have here, the Republican Party has tried to retaliate or compete with Democrats by using race, like with the GOP's reaction to Obama's State of the Union, with the mayor of New Orleans.
Yes.
And 3 years ago, a senior White House press lady mentioned, I was at a conference here, she mentioned that Condoleezza Rice might run for the presidency.
Right.
And my question is, have you heard any insight info about her running or the Republican Party using another minority to compete with Obama and or the Democrats?
We already see that the Republican Party is using a minority to come up against President Obama with Michael Steele, African-American head of the RNC. Now, as far as Condoleezza Rice, I think that was a while ago that they were floating the idea, but it didn't work because of her views on abortion and her views on affirmative action. And it wouldn't have floated with a lot of the Christian right, her views on abortion and some other things. So they tried to float it. It didn't work, especially when they thought that Hillary Clinton was going to run. So I think race is a factor. Race is a factor in this society. And the GOP has an African American. They have an African American leader of their party now. And you have an African American leader of the Democratic Party who happens to be also the leader of the free world, also the leader of the country. So race is a factor. But we'll see how it plays out. I don't know how it's going to play out. It could work out for the best. You never know with the situation, or it could work out in reverse. We'll see.
Has there been an effort by the Republican Party to recruit black state legislators or office holders to run for House seats or Senate seats?
Oh, yes. There's a big effort. There's really been a big effort. I remember during the first term of the Bush administration, they were so happy with their numbers of the black vote. I'll never forget, J.C. Watts was outside, a former congressman, Oklahoma congressman, Republican congressman, African-American. And I remember him at stakeout one day outside the White House at the bank of microphones. He said something to the effect, oh, yes, I'm looking for 40% of the black vote. And I thought that was very odd, you know, the next time, you know, they ran for president. And, you know, the Republicans tried to run for president. And it was very odd to go from the numbers that they'd gone up in number, but...
Was that after 2004?
When he got in 2000. No, this was the first term.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, this was the first term. So it was just very interesting because the second term, they weren't going to get it after Katrina. And, you know, this was maybe just before the University of Michigan amicus brief decision when he said this. So, and that started turning the tides. President Bush was against any kind of favoritism for the University of Michigan, race-based favoritism for students to get scholarships into the University of, or get into the University of Michigan, admissions into the University of Michigan. And that really caused a lot of ruckus within the black community. And but he, to his credit, he was the first president to ban racial profiling on a federal level. But you don't hear much about that.
Okay. Towson? You're breaking up, so I don't know if you're prepared to go more slowly or get a little farther away from the microphone. One of those.
Do you feel with the amount of events and press that President Obama is putting out there, do you feel like he is susceptible to being overexposed and disenfranchising some of the American public with the amount of information that he's putting out there and the fact that he's constantly doing interviews?
Yeah, he definitely runs a risk of being overexposed, but this administration, they call themselves the risk takers. They say they've always taken risks, and if they hadn't taken risks, they wouldn't have gotten this far. So some people call him the rock star in chief. You never know. But he does well on Jay Leno. He does well, to a certain extent.
Yeah. I think the downside of that one was, was greater than the upside.
Well, at first it was okay. At first everybody thought it was okay, but once you saw it, if he would have, with the omission of that, if he could have just stayed the course, mm-hmm. He would have been fine. But what I'm saying is he works well with his conversation. He's very conversational. He's very personable. He does well with the camera, and he knows this. And so does his staff. So that's one of the reasons why they want to get him out there. He is considered one of the best advertisements for himself and for this administration that you could ever have, in their opinion. And he does talk a lot. He does a lot of interviews. But I think that he could be in jeopardy of being oversaturated. But at the same time, as I said, they are risk takers. Beyond his Special Olympics comment, I think it was a decent interview, because I was kind of concerned, because Dr. Kumar and I had the conversation. I was like, I don't know. But if you took that Special Olympics cutout, I think it was a halfway decent interview.
Except you can't do that.
You can't do that.
The problems when presidents get into a different environment like that, then they start, but they fall into the environment. For example, Clinton went on MTV, and so one young woman asked what kind of underwear he wore, where he wore boxers or brief, and he answered the question. So I think, you run a risk in that kind of environment.
He always wants to seem presidential, but what I wanted to say is, I think for him to, and everyone questioned at first, Jay Leno, the nation's in a bad economic downturn, not just the nation, the world. And we're wondering, how is he going to balance jokes with the economy? And I know you don't like to deal with the issue of that joke, but if you took that out of there, if you turned your head and closed one eye, I think, he handled that part. I was surprised at how he handled it. Looking at it, I said, wow. I said, he could, be personable and talk about the economy. And I said, because I thought it was a bad mix. How can you be so somber and then go on a show that you have laughs and singing and, comedy? But it worked to a certain extent for them, I think.
Okay, there. Let's pass it over.
I actually have two questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
My first is relating to the speaker that we had last week, Bill Burton. He had talked a lot about openness and transparency, and I guess we all know that from the campaigns and everything, that Obama wants to have a very transparent administration, at least from the last administration. And I was wondering if, as a reporter, if you've noticed any change, in the amount of time that they'll spend on any one topic. So that's my first question. And then the second is, you've described yourself as being specialty media, not the mainstream, but sometimes you go with the mainstream. I'm wondering if, with the past three presidents, and I know that you've had good experience with both Clinton and Bush, but have you ever noticed that they may try to avoid questions from you or from specialty media because they feel like you may have a certain type of question that they don't want to deal with?
I could imagine that being the case for all of them, because when there's something that you don't want to deal with, let's say, for instance, Monica Lewinsky, Lewinsky scandal during the Clinton administration. It derailed a lot of programs. I remember at the time he was holding his race initiative, and he was supposed to have town hall meetings. They cut back on the town hall meetings because they didn't want anyone getting up and talking about this when they were supposed to be talking about race. And they were very sensitive. They really knew that people were upset about that, and that reporters were feeling the pulse of the country and wanting to find out. We were very hypersensitive about it. Looking back, should have taken as much time looking back, but you learn from your mistakes, but it was still news. And of course, they're not going to call in certain reporters, or they're going to figure out a response to a certain reporter if they had to call in. President Bush, yeah, there were a lot of things that he didn't want to, you know, answer. I mean, going back from Karl Rove, all of Karl Rove's.
Yeah, I remember in a particular press conference, Bush would go down the line, mm-hmm. and he would just go down the row. And Dana Milbank was the White House correspondent, and he had written an article in the Post that had, I think it was a front page one too, and the headline on it was Taking Liberties with the Truth. And it was just a few days later that Bush had a press conference, and it was in the old executive office building. And he went right down that line and just went right over Milbank. And he did that with Helen, too, with Helen Thomas, just right over. Every now and then he would call on her, and then he always regretted it. But he didn't do it very often.
Yeah.
So they definitely... have a history of doing that.
Yeah, and I think this president doesn't want to focus too much on the issue of race right now because people are very hypersensitive about it, and it may be something that, you know, he could regret because he wants to go for another term, and right now it might not be politically savvy for him to continue to focus in on race, but he can focus in on it by giving it to his Office of Faith or to the urban initiative that he has, the Urban Policy Office, so instead of directly dealing with those questions. So you kind of know, you kind of gauge what people are going to ask or kind of feel what people are going to ask, and you pick according to that.
What about transparency?
Oh, transparency.
Do you find that this administration is more transparent than the Bush administration, and then go back to Clinton or the Clinton administration?
What did Bill Burton say about transparency last week? If you don't mind me asking.
Well, I mean, he talked about their efforts. That I think they see themselves as doing a lot. They have, they have the website that they put things up on. But in other parts of the government too. If you look at OMB, OMB has put up a lot of stuff. But I think they see themselves as being more transparent, and if in some areas they aren't, it's just some kind of screw-ups. For example, there have been cases where they have not released or put on their website executive orders that the president has signed or memoranda, and instead, but you can find them on the Federal Register. So one of the things I do is I look for that. And if I'm looking for appointments, I look on the Senate calendar. I look in a lot of different places, and I don't just rely on them because I know that sometimes they are so overwhelmed that that sometimes the information just simply doesn't get out.
As a reporter, you always want more transparency, and you never can get enough transparency. But there is a criticism, you know, this website, how they're charting where the money's going in the stimulus package. It doesn't give you enough of a breakdown, you know. That's one of my complaints about transparency. Give me the breakdown a little bit more, not just the scale of all of this is going there. Break it down as to how we want to know the nuts and bolts that go into making this line that you have here that says this number here. You know, we want to know everything that goes into it. And they feel they're being transparent. They're putting it up, but we want to know more. And that's a reporter's job, to find out more. And I don't think there's ever enough transparency.
Like who's getting the contracts and then run a cross-check with the campaign donations?
Well, that's transparency, yes. Yes.
Towson?
Check on the government and as an essential part of it that keeps it in line?
That's a very interesting question, but to a certain extent, but I don't think so it's, we both hold each other accountable. I think there has to be an accountability mechanism for each side. And I think for a journalist, we ask them questions, because if there were no questions to be asked of a president or of any politician, what would happen? In some cases, some of the most extreme things could happen. But I think it's a very important mechanism. We, as journalists, White House correspondents, we are the buffer between what the American public wants to ask the president to the president giving the answers. And we, to a certain extent, are fact checkers. When I say a journalist, I'm not talking about an opinion person, a commentator. I'm talking about a journalist, someone who gets the various angles, the different sides of stories. More than two in a lot of cases, two sides to a story. And, you know, to present that, to present these sides or this side, that side, or the other side to a president to get him to tell us what's going on in his opinion or what's going on in the administration, that is an accountability. Also, they're holding us accountable for asking them the questions and finding out, making sure that we find out the situation as it is, as it really is. Also, bringing them stories, like Dr. Kumar said, about the black farmers, about issues of reparations, about Hurricane Katrina, what's happening on the ground. A lot of times, these people are in a bubble and they don't know. So it's a back and forth, and I think, you know, we are holding each other accountable.
Okay. And then one question here. Anybody have another question? Anybody who has not asked a question before? Okay, you get the. Larry, do you want to ask a question?
Well, of course I want to ask. I was going to give my students a chance, but.
She's already had one, so you can get one. You'll have the last one here.
This has been very interesting, and thank you very much for being here. Actually, it's just when you were talking about the Clinton and the Bush presidencies, the comparison between them, particularly their relationship with the black community. Could you talk a little about why you think President Bush, pre-Katrina, that is, in the first 2 years of his administration, for example, I mean, he really had, through his appointment process to the cabinet, in particular, Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice, he probably, you know, did more in terms of the appointment of African-Americans to key positions in an administration than any previous president.
President Bush.
Mm-hmm. But he never got any credit for it. There was no resonance in the black community. Whereas President Clinton would always get credit for it. And I'm just curious what's your take on that and how you might explain it, because it's something that's always puzzled me pre-Katrina, that is, in particular in the first 2 years of the administration.
You know, it was interesting. A Democrat, a high-ranking Democrat, told me that it would have to be a Republican to make these major moves, and it was President Bush. Now, it's interesting, in the black community, a lot of people gravitated to Colin Powell. They really loved him, they liked him, and they still admire him. Condoleezza Rice, they were, you know, okay with. They recognized her, and they were proud of her being African-American, but they did not espouse the ideology and the thoughts of President Bush. So therefore, yeah, you're there, but, you know, are you really one of us? And that's been the concern with African Americans when it came to the Bush administration. Are you really one of us? Because some of the things that the University of Michigan, you know, also the issue of a slavery apology. He said, no, I'm not going to apologize for slavery, because I was dogging Bill Clinton about that. And we went to Africa. And, you know, it's so interesting, even with all of what George W. Bush did for Africa, he did more than any other president for Africa. And he still, you know, he received awards. And yet and still, as you say, a lot of credit is not given to him. But I believe it is the perception, or is it the reality, that, okay, he may have done this, but did he really help us? Is he really working with us? So, I don't know. And you know, it is interesting also, in a conversation, a private conversation, another private conversation I had with him, you know, when I talked to him, I said, why didn't you go out on the road and go into the black community and talk to them, you know, like you're talking? He said, you know, April, he said, I know why African Americans did not vote for me. I said, why? He said, because of my dad. You know, I'm a Republican. I was the governor of Texas, which is considered a racist state. My record on capital punishment. So he understood, and it was almost, it was like, you know, no matter what we do, it's not going to be enough. It was almost like that, wouldn't you say, Dr. Kumar?
Yeah. And there were people in the administration, because I asked them about Africa, why he had not gotten the credit for Africa. And there were aides that said that it was counterintuitive, that people just assumed that that he was not doing, that he wouldn't really do anything for the black community, and there was no way that they could get over it. And they knew that they would never be able to get over that hump. But they also said that one of the reasons was that that news organizations had cut back enormously their foreign coverage, and like on television, which is what they were interested in, that on television you had a shrinking news hole for foreign policy coverage, and all of it was going to Iraq. And then the fact that they often didn't cover what was going on in Africa, that he wouldn't get any credit for it that way either.
And I'm not touting one president over another at all. I'm not touting one. But it's just interesting to hear a president of the United States basically tell you why he knew, you know, what the black community would do or how they thought of him. And then at the same time, you know, as Dr. Kumar said, you know, he's doing all this for Africa, but at the same time, too, you have, now this is after Katrina, you got Hurricane Katrina, you know, and you've got the amicus brief, you've got Hurricane Katrina. He's, you know, his fight with the NAACP, it, ultimately he did go to the convention, but it was not a Cinderella story for him with the black community through his 8 years, so, and he knew it. But could he have done something else differently? Yes, of course. Could Katrina have been his saving grace if he would have? Yes. That was his time to ride him on a white horse, like that person said. And it was not necessarily him at the beginning. It was his people underneath you. Sometimes you're only as good as your people. And some of them were out of the country, and it was vacation. And I still am boggled by what happened there.
Okay. Thank you very much, April.
Thank you, Dr. Kumar.